Welcome to This Family Life, a podcast sharing ideas and tips on how you can organise the chaos of family life. My name's Nicole Avery, and throughout the podcast, you'll hear from myself and other families and the things that they do to make family life that little bit easier. Welcome to the This Family Life podcast, episode 20. Today I'm interviewing a couple. I'm interviewing Ben and Brooke, who live in New South Wales, Australia, and have two kids, aged 5 and 7. Ben and Brooke were just a delight to talk to, and it was just so great to hear them share about a current life change they've made. Ben resigned from his full-time job at the start of this year and started up a business that he and Brooke are running together. Jackrabbit FM, the podcast network that this podcast is part of their business. And they take us through, I guess, the adjustments they've made, how life's, I guess, a lot better with Ben working different hours and being home more. Being home more means he can help out more, but how it took some, it has taken some time for them to get used to that. They've got some great tips on, I guess, tilting and trying some experiments when you're trying to make life change and introduce change to the kids. At the end of the episode, they have some fabulous book recommendations, a couple I'm really quite keen to get my hands on. So you'll find links to those in the show notes, which is planningwithkids.com/podcast. You can also use the hashtag ThisFamilyLifePod if you want to get in touch on the social media networks. And thanks for listening. And here is my interview with Ben and Brooke. Welcome to This Family Life, and today I have two people to interview, not just one, and I'm really, really thrilled to have both Brooke and Ben on, because something I wanted to do on the podcast was actually talk to, I guess, a family where both partners are heavily involved from work and home aspects, and Brooke and Ben are also the fabulous pair behind Jackrabbit FM, who make these podcasts sound so wonderful. So thank you for that, and I'll hand over to Brooke and Ben now to give themselves a bit of an introduction.
Thanks, Nick. So we're a married couple, live just outside of Sydney, and we've got two kids who are 5 and 7. And at the beginning of this year, Ben, he quit his full-time job to become self-employed in communications consulting and also to run our podcast network. And, so it's been an interesting journey the past 6 or 7 months since he's been at home a lot more. Hasn't it?
It definitely has.
Well, it's a super large change for you, Ben. I guess I'm really interested to hear, I guess, how both of you adjusted to, I guess, Ben, I know you do some travel for work, but when my husband's been home on holidays and stuff and I work from home, I found the adjustment to having him around quite substantial, and I find, just my routines, it sort of threw them out and that sort of stuff. How has the adjustment process gone, I guess, with you being at home? So I guess, Ben, if you could say how you found it, and then perhaps Brooke, you also.
Absolutely. I'll be happy to. I think the biggest challenge for me was being able to help Brooke during what was previously my work hours and which continue to be my work hours. So the disruption, I guess, that I was physically in the house, and what was a little bit challenging in the first couple of months and to a certain extent sort of continues to this day. But I guess it was seeing Brooke, you know, at home, managing the household, but while also running a business was a little bit inspiring for me, because it showed the amount that she could get through in a day, and really challenged me to step up and pick up quite a lot of the home duty aspects. And I guess the whole premise for me making this career change was to actually do that, was to be more around to help Brooke. But I, you know, it wasn't without a few hiccups along the way, that's for sure.
that is for sure. It was, so Ben went from working, he'd leave home at 7, sometimes between 6 and 7, and get home between 7 and 8 most nights. And that's been the case since the kids were little. So to go from that to him still working in the city some days, some weeks not at all, some weeks 3 or 4 days a week, but you know, to have him around a lot more was really challenging. And like, that sounds quite bizarre, I think, but because I just had my rhythms and I had my set ways of doing things, and then to have Ben here and absolutely happy and willing to help out, but maybe not quite entirely sure of the best way to do that, was sort of a real adjustment for me. So we're 7 months in, and I feel like we're only just starting to find our feet, if I'm perfectly honest. Yeah.
It's really, it reminds me back to a time, Phil, my husband, did an MBA, and that was a really full-on time for us. He was working full-time and studying part-time and still playing sport. So he wasn't around a whole lot, and that was in the year that we had gave birth to our fourth child. And what I found was after that period calmed down and, you know, I think he went through the whole year where our baby was born in April, he didn't finish until pretty much the December, I found I was part of the problem in that I wasn't letting go. Like, he was prepared to do things. I had become so used to doing everything on my own. And I also just mentally, like, there'd be something on the weekend and I just assumed he wouldn't be around. I just would go, okay, so we're doing this weekend. And it took me a long time and to actually go, you know what, actually, I don't have to do all this on my own anymore. I can let go. And it's sort of letting control back, like, was really a difficult, I found I quite struggled with that. And so I also found too, if I didn't let go, not because he didn't want to do it, he just, again, it wasn't things he would know to do, so he wouldn't ask necessarily. But then I'd still be frustrated thinking, well, you seem to have a really relaxed life. What the hell's going on? I'm still really, really busy. But it was really communication, I think, was the key. So how do you guys make sure you're communicating through those issues? Is it just, are you both, you know, big talkers? How does that work?
No, I think we're both copers, which doesn't always lend itself really well to clearing that kind of stuff. And I think we've realized that if we're not open about how we're feeling before it becomes a problem, then that's where, you know, the resentment and the control issues sort of start to become problematic. So I think it's really being super mindful of how we're feeling. You know, if I feel myself getting frustrated or a bit bitter about the way things are unfolding, it rather than kind of just harbor that and suck it up as I used to have to, it's about kind of dealing with it head on before it becomes a problem. Ben's looking at me out of the corner of his eye right now.
I agree, because for me a lot of it is visual cues. I will know. You know, the last 7 months, I've learned some really new skill sets, Nick. I've
got to
say, and really, I'm a champion of that. You know, 80% of communication is nonverbal. For me, I just instinctively know now if Brooke is doing more, you know, her more than her fair share. So I take a lot from that, actually, and I think we're both pretty good at that, especially. Because, yeah, maybe we're not as verbal as maybe some other couples, but, you know, it's a really interesting thing. Do you agree with the...
Oh, look, I have this thing where I don't even realize I'm doing it, but I furrow my brow and my husband will look at me and he goes, what's wrong? I go, what do you mean what's wrong? He goes, there's so many creases in your brow at the moment. Yes. So there's obviously something's really aggravating you. And so there is so much, because, and sometimes I'll even know, I'll say one thing, but my body language is so tense, it's so tight, and I feel like I might put something down on the ground a little bit harder than I wanted to. There is so much in that verbal stuff that, and I think you have to, you really, especially if you're in a, you know, you're working in that same space, you have to pick it up. And I guess I'd be interested to hear about the impact on the kids, because obviously those are long hours that you were away, and very similar when Phil was studying and working long hours. What I found is we almost had to retrain the kids to that their dad could actually help them with stuff. It was like, you know, he'd be in one room with them and they'd walk out of that room and come and get me to do something for them or help them solve a fight or whatever. So there was a whole lot of retraining back to the kids. Like, you know, dad's here. I guess your kids are probably similar age to some of mine. How have the kids reacted to you being around a bit more, Ben?
It's exactly the same. The amount of times that the kids over the last 7 months saying, Mum, can you help me? And they might be staring straight at me and calling me Mum. So I totally get that. I also I think it's funny with our kids, because naturally one of them will go to Brooke for help and assistance and the other one will come to me. So I thought that that's sort of interesting, and it's almost training the other one, you know, I am here and I am available. And they, you know, both of them are not they don't naturally ask for a lot of help, do they?
No, they don't. But it is nice to have that, you know, have the support network a little wider now. You know, whereas before it was just by virtue of the fact that Ben was away with work for so much of the day, it was just on me, and that weighed really heavily. So while there's frustration, we, like you say, Nick, you know, the kids can be in the room with Ben and then come and find me for the help. It's still, in, you know, overall a real relief to have him at home and have two sets of hands and two brains on the job.
Oh, and I always think of single parents, because some days at the end of the day, you just need someone just to hand off to.
Absolutely.
You know what? I've just had my limit today. Someone else, especially with the teenagers, I'll just look at Phil. Again, it's not verbal. I'll just look at him and he goes, I'll go deal with it. because he just looks at me and goes, man, you know, the tank's empty in terms of the parenting kit tonight, so I just need to move on.
Exactly the same. But the only difference is Brooke often has a glass of red wine in her hand.
You got to do what you got to do in those times of the night, that's for sure. So in terms of work hours, Ben, I'm presuming, are you full-time and is Brooke, are you part-time? Is that the way it's sort of running?
Pretty much, yeah. Most weeks that's what it looks like. Ben has weeks that are much more full on than others and weeks that are much lighter on than others. But I'd say average it out and he would be working close to full-time hours and I'd be working part-time, like a pretty full part-time but still definitely part-time.
Yeah.
And that was a conscious decision, that's the way you wanted to keep the hours? Because I've just been finished reading this book called Unfinished Business by Anne-Marie Slaughter, and it's she wrote a pretty famous article in The Atlantic saying why women can't have it all when she stepped down from a job with Hillary Clinton because she needed to go back to help her teenagers, and her partner, who's also a professor, was there. And it's just made me really think a lot about some of the decisions I've made to go part-time in my life, and I think it's absolutely where I want to be. But it has made me – it's challenged a lot of my own thoughts about the evolution of women working more part-time and men working more full-time. So is there a view where you think you'll both be part-time or you'll change hours? What's the – I guess, is that the idea with setting up your own business? Was that factors and ideas involved in that?
Absolutely. I mean, the short-term plan was always that I would be still working on a full-time basis and that Brooke will slowly work the Jackrabbit FM business and the podcasting business and the Slow Your Home business up to complement that. So, yeah, 3 or 5 years, we hope that it is more of a 50-50 split. Wouldn't it be great if we're working part-time? It's definitely a goal. We'd both love – absolutely love that. But yes, definitely for the first couple of years, we always knew that my communications background and that side of the business would, you know, sort of be 80-90% of the work, really, and that we will continue to build up the other side of the business. So,
and the other part of it for me really was I didn't want to challenge myself in that way in terms of working like a full 40 or 50 hour week while also doing, you know, a lot of the stuff with the kids at school and you know, the after school homework and activities and all that kind of stuff. That's not something that we needed for me to do. Like, I didn't need to go back into a full-time employment in that capacity. So it was a really nice alignment of what we wanted and also what we're able to do. So, you know, it was fortunate, but also definitely by design.
So can you take us what a typical day, if there is such a thing, if any family, it looks like? So who does the drop-offs, the pick-ups, that sort of stuff? And I guess, Brooke, when do you fit your work in?
I mean, we're pretty fluid, actually. I think whatever our day looks like, for example, on this, you know, this hypothetical day, you know, if Ben's around, he will usually do the drop-off just simply because he's not around as often to do it. So if he's here, then he'll do the drop-offs. If he's not, then I'm happy to do the drop-offs. We split things like literacy groups at school now. Same thing, whoever doesn't have a meeting or have, you know, a full day of work will do literacy groups at school a couple of days a week. And I try to work from, you know, about 9:30 in the morning through to 2:30 in the afternoon. They're really my work hours. there's mornings that I get up and work if I have to, and there's evenings occasionally, although I think we're much better at not doing that very often anymore. But if I have to, I'll work for a couple of hours in the evening as well. And, you know, Ben will either – I think the most important thing for us is that one of us is around in the afternoons, you know, and if Ben is working from home, he will often work in the office so that he gets an extra couple of hours before dinner time and all that kind of stuff. I might take the opportunity to go to the gym and the kids come with me to the gym. And, you know, I think it is really just more so than a strict routine. It's just a mindfulness of what's happening with the other person and what's happening with the kids and making sure that, you know, we feel like we're where we need to be most of the time.
I think we're really, really incredibly lucky that that's worked like that.
Oh, absolutely.
That sounds like chaos theory for a lot of people, but it really does work for us. I think we're really lucky with that. The way that I see it, I've got 2 days. I'm either, you know, the on day is me heading, you know, waking up early, going into Sydney and working full days there, you know, and that's over 8 hours, and it's all my work day is very concentrated into those 8 hours, and then I can come home and be really present at dinner and then putting the kids to bed. The off day is when I'm at home and I'm able to, yeah, drop the kids off, work for four and a half, 5 hours during the day while they're at school, and then be able to help out once they're back from school. And we sort of tic-tac, don't we, on the duties after that, whether it's helping the kids with activities or cooking dinner. I mean, I certainly prefer the off days.
Well, who wouldn't? Yeah.
But I guess as someone who works from home herself as well, I love it and I wouldn't change it. But that doesn't mean it doesn't come with challenges because you're in an environment where you could be doing so many things in the home as well. How do you, I guess, stay focused and make sure you get your work done, especially, you know, you've obviously got deadlines you need to meet because you've got clients, you know, and people like myself who rely on you to get stuff done. What sort of strategies do you have in place to make sure everything gets done when it does get done?
An alarm at 4 o'clock.
I think I struggle with that side of it more than Ben. Like, I find it much more difficult to switch off from home Brooke to work Brooke. And just in terms of, like, you know, housework and that kind of stuff, like the really mundane things, but they just need to happen. So for me, it's a combination, I think, of being more forgiving with my standards now that I'm working at home and working far more hours than I have been previous years. So, you know, if the laundry doesn't get finished or the clothes don't get folded and put away, like, that's okay, because I'm at this point in time, you know, shifting between work and home and managing everyone's needs and expectations. So that's part of it for me. That's how I kind of rationalize the fact that things aren't getting done maybe how they used to be or how I would like them to be in an ideal world. And that's, like, most of the time I'm okay with that. And then I think the other part of it is I just need to be quite focused. And, you know, I run the podcasting side of it, for example, particularly the network shows. I have a really strict schedule that I check in with every single day to make sure that I'm not sort of overseeing anything or, you know, missing an episode or missing a deadline. So it's this kind of strange combination of being more flexible and forgiving and being more focused that seems to work for me.
Yeah, for me, I think it helps with the type of work we do, where we're doing a lot of writing, and I'm a huge believer in the sort of you work for 30 minutes and then you've got to get up and, you know, do something else for 5 or 10 minutes. Been working at home and doing that allows you to then get up and go and feed the chickens and put the rubbish out. And that's where you sort of have the ideas for the next sort of next 30 minutes and the wave of work. So that I really, really prefer doing that at home. And it actually helps me a lot if I'm working and have to get up and do a chore or put the clothes on the line or something. It just takes me out of that headspace, and it's certainly a lot better than being stuck in an office and going to, you know, the water cooler or something and having mundane conversations with co-workers.
Mundane housework instead.
No. Well, it's, you know, how much does that help us out?
Oh, absolutely. It's so fine. Yeah.
But I also think your point, though, about that's where the ideas come, is just a hugely a huge one. It's something I guess I'm doing some presentations coming up, but it's some things I've been focusing on a lot lately and I'm trying to get my kids, is that we shouldn't be entertained the whole entire time. So, you know, my kids will do homework and then they go straight onto Facebook and social media and stuff. And it's like, you know, just let your brain just have just some moments where you're not, something's not entertaining you. And I found I do the same thing myself. So when I work in, you know, blocks of time like yourself, sometimes it's half an hour, sometimes an hour, depending on the task. And I don't take my break by going on Facebook or social media, because I find that A, I end up spending way too much time doing that, and B, I don't move away from the computer either. And if I sit there for too long, I become really stale. So the opportunity to go hang out a load of washing, it's actually a really good one, because it's like yourself, I will then think of something else that I'll end up never be writing down, and it just really freshens us up. And there's just one thing I just really did love about what you had to say, Brooke, and it's something that I've found. The last 2 years I've set myself one key goal, and what happens when you focus on one thing? It's not to the detriment of everything else, but that's your core focus. So when I start work every day, I have to be working on my one thing first. Is that when you do something like that, you actually have to learn, it's what I call, you have to embrace the undone.
Yes.
Because it is absolutely not possible to do everything that you want to do, because we just want to do too many things. So sometimes embracing the undone means that I do, like I said to you today, I had to clean the house because work had taken over a bit last week, and that I did just accept that, you know, I wouldn't just clean the house. Instead, I actually sat and read to the kids and I made those other choices. That you need to adjust your standards and embrace the undone and know that it will change again in another time. Next week will look different, as opposed to, because in the previous couple of years, I would have just stayed up and worked to midnight to get the house looking how I wanted to. And that actually makes me a poor mum at the next day. I'm much more short-tempered, and then I'm, you know, unproductive at work because I'm too tired. So I think that's it's a great, the lowering the standards and just accepting that is just great advice. So I think that's
perfect. Yeah, I feel like this, you know, the idea of tilting, I know you've talked about it before, and just being where you need to be in that moment and just saying, you know, I can't actually be doing all of these things all at once. So where do I need to be? Where does my focus need to be? Be all in that, and then be all in something else, you know, and understand that that means that there's going to be things that slip and things that get, you know, the lion's share of your attention in the meantime. And that's like, that's okay. That's actually how I tend to get things done a lot more than if I was trying to split myself across, you know, 5 or 10 different projects and different focuses.
Yeah, I'm exactly the same.
Yeah.
So I might get on to, I guess, something which I love the way you have a sort of a slow living approach to family life. And it's something that I've really, look, I'm way far from where probably I would like to be, but I certainly have slowed down over the last couple of years, and it's just been the best thing ever for me. Like, I'm happier, the kids are happier. Still work in progress. With 5 kids in the family, there's always going to be a lot going on, but it's certainly something that I'm working on. But it isn't always easy when you've been so used to being ramped up quite a lot. So I'd be really keen to hear, I guess, how you deal with some of the kids' stuff and trying to lead a more slow, intentional life. So things like after-school activities and parties and playdates and stuff, how do you manage that in your home?
I guess the advantage, or the, you know, the benefit that we have, is we sort of adapted this idea before the kids were at school. So, you know, very much in our control when they were at preschool, or even before they started preschool, they didn't do activities or anything like that, simply because they didn't show any particular interest in anything, and I wasn't going to kind of push something on them if they didn't want to do dancing or soccer or cricket or drama or whatever. And it's only been since they've been at school that they've showed interest in those sorts of things. So I think that was one of the benefits to having come across this philosophy of, you know, slow family life before the kids were at school. But now we are quite mindful of it, and we do have boundaries on after school activities, for example. The kids both do one each, which is fantastic, because it just by coincidence, they both happen on a Saturday morning. So, you know, soccer and drama, both of them, it's fantastic. So our afternoons are pretty much our own at this point in time. The kids have both showed an interest in doing rock climbing, though, which is something that we might look at doing next year. But I really like having that boundary and, you know, explain to the kids that they're not going to be able to do all of the activities that they want all at the same time because of time and money and, you know, having time together at home. And in terms of homework, is something that I can see will become more problematic as the kids get older. We're lucky that the school that they go to is not really full on in terms of homework. They might do maybe, I don't know, between 10 and 30 minutes a week of homework plus home readers and things, which everyone quite enjoys. So it's not, it doesn't feel, you know, yeah, hard exactly. And then with play dates and parties and things like that, we do our best for the kids to be able to go to the things that they're invited to, but I don't have a problem with saying no either, you know, which I think has been a big shift for me in terms of, you know, people pleasing and not kind of missing out or not doing the selfish thing. For me, it's been a really big mindset shift to not operate on other people's agendas all the time, I think. And
yeah, you're spot on, because for us, and we made a very conscious decision early on when our oldest started to go to school last year, is with the parties, it's, you know, it's an experience. They were there with their friends, and we don't want to deny them that. No. What we have the issue with is the stuff that surrounds that. So all the presents and things. So we're really conscious of, if we were to buying a gift for a friend, it would be an experience rather than a, you know, toy.
Mm.
So that's, I think, really that helps, I think, in sort of help, you know, justifying those experiences. And, you know, they have friends, and we don't want to stop them from seeing those.
No, we don't.
But it does get tricky, because, you know, I know parents that will completely change their plans just so a child can attend a party. And, you know, I probably would say earlier on, I have done such things, thinking, oh my gosh, they're going to miss out on the world's best party or something like that. But once you become a bit more conscious, or I guess the word you used before is mindful, which I think is really true with your time. If it's going to stress everyone out, you've got to run around and it's put so much pressure on it, then maybe that's just not the be all and end all. And of course, if it fits in, it fits in. And it's not about missing every single party. But there's also that is just life. And I think it's also some role modeling too, you know, and when it does happen, and it does happen occasionally because we do have so many people to get around so many places on the weekend, that we often talk about that as a family, we have to do what fits us all in. And this is what works this weekend. And I'm sorry it's fallen out that way for you. And you just need to understand that that's the way it is. And I think they're not such bad life lessons to actually be learning, although I do sometimes still suffer a lot of guilt from it. But, you know, it is even teaching them from, because I have found saying no terribly difficult. And I'm hoping that maybe that showing these choices might help them to be better at saying no than I was.
Exactly. Yeah. Because I mean, we kind of internalize a lot of pressure to be everywhere and say yes to everything and not let anyone down and not have any of our kids miss out on anything at all, because then it reflects on us. But I think that you're right. You know, learning as adults to say no, hopefully we'll lead our kids to at least understand that that's an option, you know, that's open to them. They're allowed to say no, and it's okay to say no, and it's okay to not be at every event and not, you know, not be the person who stresses themselves out trying to get to four parties in one afternoon and all that kind of stuff. I think, I think that's really a valuable life lesson, as you say. And you know what, sometimes we just can't do the things that we would like to do because there's other things happening. And, you know, we're not the only person, you know, who – like, the world doesn't revolve around us, yep, as my mum used to say to me all the time.
Yeah, I actually just said that to my oldest teenager just yesterday or the day before, because it was raining and so I had to make a trip to the train station, and they could get different trains. And I said, I'm making one trip to the train station for you. We're leaving at 7:49. And so 7:50, we're in the car and we're still waiting. And he goes, but we're still going to make it to the train on time. It's like, I understand that, but I then actually have to go home and do other things. So this actually all doesn't revolve around you, and we all have to fit in and work together. But, yeah, 17-year-olds really are just in the whole world of I, so it's just a whole another ball game. I guess we sort of did touch on it very briefly with you, Ben, so I'd love to hear a bit more about that, because, you know, with kids come stuff and, you know, toys, clothes, technology. What's your approach with that? So how do you manage, I guess, limiting what comes in, and then I guess getting rid of what you don't need after it's been in the house for a while?
It's funny you're asking me this question, Nick. So I'll try and channel Brooke.
I'd love to hear your opinion, because my husband's turned into the biggest chucker out of the kids. Open the bin all the time and they'll find some plastic toy there and they'll be retrieving stuff out of the bin. So
that's exactly like us. What I love is of a Saturday morning with the vacuum going around and sucking up all that plastic. It's just a joy. So for me, Just to answer your technology question, I think first and foremost, we sort of try and limit that as much as possible. The iPads and the iPhones and all that sort of stuff, they don't get a C. You know, the kids don't even see them during the week. They're on top of the cabinet and stay there until the weekend, where they're allowed to have some time on that. And equally with the TV as well in the mornings, we don't do that at all. That's the time we actually do our homework in the mornings. We think that's the most productive time because they're obviously often being small little ones. They're quite tired when they get home from school, so that's when we try and do our homework after breakfast, and that seems to be working for us. With the toys, one of our kids is just obsessed with dinosaurs and wants every dinosaur in the book. But we're very careful not to encourage that. You know, if he sees a dinosaur, we say, well, that's great. Well, you have got a dinosaur like that. You know, you don't need that one. You've got one like that. And you know, he's got a whole selection of dinosaurs, which he still plays with. But what Brooke does really well is that she sort of gets the kids' toys. They might have, you know, a small basket of toys or a sort of a shelf of toys that they might be playing with, where the other toys that they have, they actually get put away, and she recycles those, you know, she recycles those out now and again. And they haven't missed those toys. Those toys are there. They go to, you know, Vinnie's or somewhere like that, and they don't miss them if they don't see them.
We've got a collector, and the collectors are really quite challenging. And so each season, and like it's such a marketing scam, is that he loves the AFL footy cards, and he just buys them, and all he wants to do, like he actually wanted to, he trades them at school. But inevitably, like by the time that season's over, like it's just like, okay, he's done with that. But then the only thing I will say, my husband, who normally throws everything out, won't allow me to throw the footy card books out. And so we have got years and years, they're now in a box in the shed of all these footy cards. And it's like, we can't throw them out. They're collectors one day. It's like, oh my gosh, we're going to hold on to these forever. So you guys obviously don't have those sentimental attachment issues. We're still dealing with lots of sentiment. He's got footy cards from when he was a kid, so I've got footy cards.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So we have quite a bit of sentimental attachment issues, so I've got to work through those ones.
Yeah, I think, I mean, neither Ben nor I is particularly sentimental, but both of our kids, they're not super collectors or anything like that, but they both get a lot of enjoyment out of some of the things that they own. And, you know, I'm fine with that. Like, I'm not going to – I had someone ask me recently, would your kids identify with being minimalist? I'm like, my kids have never even heard that term. Like, that's just not – we don't talk about, you know, as a minimalist family. Yeah. They're just kids and they have stuff and they like their stuff. And I honestly think that up to a certain point – the stuff that our kids choose to surround themselves with and the ways that they play and express themselves, that's really how they find their place in the world. So I'm not going to be this hardcore parent who throws out, you know, everything that I don't see the value in, because it's not my stuff necessarily. That being said, they know that there's boundaries. Like, they've each got a shelf in their room and they've got a toy box under their bed. And once those get full, that's when it's time to rethink what they choose to keep. But I very much put it on them rather than on me at this point. And they're 5 and 7, so they're old enough to understand. They're not necessarily old enough to make like the wisest decisions, but that's okay because they're 5 and 7 and they're kids. So I think it's just trying to strike that balance between keeping things, you know, in control, but also letting them express themselves through the things that they surround themselves with. And that seems to work pretty well most of the time.
Yeah. And also too, I think it comes back to a point that you mentioned earlier, is that I guess you started this when they were little, so they actually really haven't known anything else in terms of
exactly.
That. Like, and I often say, you know, people often ask me, what would you do differently? And I think things like that, I think I would have a lot less stuff in the house if I was to do my time over again. And the other thing I say is, I was a massive white bread eater all the way up until like I gave up white bread a few years ago. And, you know, I kept, for love nor money, I cannot get my kids off white bread now because they're all way too old. And it's like anything else tastes like rubbish to them, they say. So, you know, sometimes if you've got them when they're little, it actually is easier to, I guess, mold the behaviors that you, or desirable influence that you'd like to have. So I could see how it probably wouldn't be a huge issue to you. Whereas then coming like I have now, you're trying to make the changes to ingrained behavior. That's where I think it is a lot more challenging to a certain extent.
That's one of the instances that I often sort of suggest that people experiment. I think if you kind of phrase something as an experiment rather than a we're getting rid of all this stuff, it can be a lot friendlier, I think. You know, even Courtney Carver talks about this experiment that she once ran on her husband. They had these vases, for example, that they were given as a wedding gift, and they'd sit on the dressing table in their bedroom for years. No one, to the point where you just didn't notice them. They just picked them up, dusted them, put them back there, and had done that for years. And she was decluttering and simplifying their home. She thought, I'm just going to put these away for 3 months in, you know, the back of a cupboard and see if anyone notices. And her husband didn't notice that they'd gone. So she put them back on the dressing table one day and said to him, you know, I think we might get rid of these. He said, no, we can't. They're really important to us. She said, they've been in the back of a cupboard for 3 months. You hadn't noticed. So it's, you know, it's kind of playful, I think. It can be really helpful to catch it as a playful, let's try it out, let's see what happens sort of thing. And it also stops us from slipping into that, you know, that just in case, or, well, of course we need to keep it because it's an important present sort of thing that so many of us struggle with. And I, you know, I've absolutely kept things and held onto things for that same sort of reason. So I think, particularly, I don't know. I mean, I don't have teenagers. I don't have older kids yet. So I, you know, you might be listening to this going, yeah.
No, not at all. I actually think that the words are actually really super important, because I obviously eat a pure whole foods based diet, but you know, my kids will still have pasta, not as much as they used to. And we don't have breakfast cereal and stuff, but I've had to really think carefully. So I think the experiment actually is probably a word I will start to use a little bit more, because sometimes I might say a bit of a challenge, and challenge even does sound like there has to be like a positive outcome. I know it sounds like there's more like a win, you get to win the challenge or something. Whereas I think experiment is like, yeah, let's just see what happens. Because like I'll have conversations and they say, oh, you can't eat that. And I say, well, no, actually I can eat anything I want, but I'm actually choosing not to eat that. I'm just choosing to have a more nutritious option, or I'm choosing to have this because it fuels me better for my run tomorrow. I've had to really stop, you know, and it does sound like, oh yeah, it's just words or whatever, but it actually is really, really important, because they'll mimic those words back to you. So I really like the idea of experiment, and I think that's something that I'll have to adapt. I've just got one more question before I go into the final questions, and because it's something that I've been thinking about lately too, is that with the big decisions, like, you know, once we get through different phases, like there was the toddler phase and then there was the challenging 4.5 phase, I'll go off and I guess it's probably because I am the primary carer, I sort of, you know, even choosing schools and when they go to school and that sort of stuff, I'll go off and do the research and I'll come back to Phil and I'll say, this is what I think, blah, 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 blah. And he'll go, yep, sounds good to me. That's all okay. I'm quite interested to see what's the process for, I guess, solving those sort of, you know, if you've got challenges with the kids, how do you and Ben work out, you know, the approach to take if, you know, when they start school or if they're having trouble at school, how do you guys navigate through that?
That's a really good question, actually, Nick. I think I'd have to say that up until this year at least, I've probably been doing the majority of the initial thinking about that kind of stuff, simply because, like, for example, our daughter was born in February, so there was a period where we weren't sure if she was going to go to school young or kind of hold back for another year. And that was something that I think I'd spoken with the preschool about quite extensively before Ben and I really sat down and talked about it. And I think that's only because I was the one who was at the preschool every week and talking to the teachers and, you know, getting their read on the situation before we were really informed enough to talk about it. But I think this year, Ben's seeing a lot more of the frontline stuff, that you're seeing a lot more of the issues that can come up at school and that kind of thing that you probably just, like, it's not that you weren't aware of up until this year, but you just weren't sort of in all the time. So I think that's another thing that we're really shifting our approach on, is to kind of come at those decisions much more 50-50.
Yeah, I can unequivocally say that Brooke basically did everything before this year. In terms of the challenge, in terms of those things, you did the research, you had the discussions, you were really they're making the decision. And you'd come to me and you'd say, these are the facts, these are the figures, these are the forecasts, these are the trends.
I'd do the lobbying.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think about this? And, you know, I'd back it because I wouldn't have that. I didn't see any of it. So now I've just tried to be more adaptive, more responsive, more agile, and try to sort of basically help out as much as possible. I think you do still take the lead though.
Probably. Yeah. And I think the part of that's habit and, you know, just social construct of what it looks like in the wider kind of picture. But yeah, exactly. I think it's an interesting question, actually.
Do you think you feel more confident, Ben, though, to make some of those decisions now? Because the last couple of years I did do a lot more travel for work and I did leave Phil at home with the kids on his own. And it wasn't really until then, and he often said that were some of the best moments for him in terms of learning for parenting, because he had to just make a lot of decisions when normally he would have just gone, oh, this is happening, what do you reckon, or whatever. He actually found that he has a lot more confidence now at home all the time because he's done that solo parenting a number of times now, and he's just got, because I think parenting a lot of the time is a confidence game a lot of the time with kids. Do you feel more confident now that you're around a bit more?
Absolutely. You know, 2015, if Brooke was away for a period of time, which she was, you know, some days, you know, you would have overnights or a couple of overnights actually. Mm. Often at night I'd have both kids crying out for their mum. So I don't know whether that was the age or just because I just wasn't around as much. And that really, you know, that kind of impacts you a little bit, you know, your self-worth and you start to doubt your ability. This year, it's just totally different. I really feel that, you know, I'm accepted more by the kids as being able to, you know, fix things and get through things and talk to teachers at school and help them, you know, with, you know, problems that they might have with friends or whatever. So I definitely think that just being around more has helped.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I agree.
Okay, so just the last couple of questions. What book, I mean, you both can give an answer here too, has been the biggest influence on you as a parent? And it doesn't actually have to be a parenting book.
Two for me, a book called Slow Living. That was written in 2006. Why? Because basically it painted a picture of a hectic, busy life, and then on the next page painted this wonderful picture of this family that has gone and lived in Italy for 24 months and was all about slow living, slow food, slow travel. And that really sort of that was sort of the light at the end of the tunnel for me, and one of the main influences why I sort of started to work towards working for myself. The second book was Yes Please by Amy Poehler.
Good. I'll link to those in the show notes, which is great. And Brooke, do you have one or two?
Yeah, I've got a couple. The first is a book that my psychiatrist recommended to me when I was seeing her during my postnatal depression kind of, you know, funk and fog and struggle. It's called The Whole Brain Child by Dan Siegel, and I think it's Tina Bryson. And it's lots of strategies to help help parents and headstrong children cope with emotions and how to reframe them and engage all parts of the child's brain in dealing with them. And it was helpful to me then, but it's actually becoming even more helpful to me now as our kids get older. It's really practical strategies in how to deal with emotional stress as well, I think. And it's a fantastic book. Highly, highly recommend. And the other one is To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh, I do love that book.
Me too.
And I was utterly, utterly disappointed when my eldest child read it in year 10 and said he hated it. It made me so...
Oh, no!
He is being in a really contrary stage of his life, so I think part of it was because I loved it so much and he knew I loved it so much. I think he wanted to say that just to make me feel sad.
Oh, wow.
What's the last item that you've bought that's helped make family life easier?
A roof over our back deck.
Oh, no, I can relate to that, actually. I
which
want
has
one.
Enabled our kids just to be able to be outside during the rain and everything else.
Yeah, those small things make a huge difference. That's on our list of things hopefully to get done this year. And just, I guess, a bit of advice from each of you that you'd give to a new mum or a new dad, and it doesn't have to be about babies, but something you've learnt, I guess, in your journey as parents that's been a game changer for you.
For me, it would be just to take a minute every day and slow down. And that's the kind of advice that I would have rolled my eyes at as a new parent, because it was like, yeah, great. That's great advice, but I can't, I don't have time. But it would be hanging out the washing, for example, just paying attention to what's happening in front of you right at that moment. It sounds like such a simple, silly little step to take, but that is where my salvation was, in those moments of peace. Even if I'm doing something, it's just focusing on that one thing rather than the 50 other thoughts that are going through your head at the time. And I think if you allow yourself that 30 seconds, that 1 minute of just being, it's a real game changer.
Oh, completely agree. And Ben?
For me, it's basically the comparison game is a losing game and to go your own way.
I love that. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you guys on today, and I guess the thing that I've loved the most is that, you know, the change that you've made to your life has obviously, you know, it's not going to have been 100% easy, because it's growing your own business from scratch is quite difficult. But it's something that we've found in our life is that the more time Phil has in the family, I think the better our family life has become. And I hope that, you know, anyone who listens to this may, you know, especially the dads, may encourage to think about ways that they can, you know, spend some more time at home, even if it's a day week at home working from home, because I think the benefit to the whole family is huge, really huge. So thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thanks, Nick. It was awesome.
Thank you for listening to This Family Life. If you've picked up a tip or two along the way and listening to the show, we'd really love it if you would leave us a review on iTunes. Leaving a review on iTunes does help other families find us, and hopefully that'll help them find tips that can help them organise the chaos of family life too. If you'd like to get in touch, you can do so by going to planningwithkids.com/podcast, and you'll find all my contact details there. Thanks again.
Jackrabbit FM.
For your ears.
Who is that?
Hi, Puck Pass.